Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 17th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. With yesterday's House of Representatives vote repudiating President Bush's surge policy and the Senate meeting an emergency session today to discuss the same, and an increasing number of voices speaking out against the Cheney-Bush plan to extend the war into Iran, we're reaching a real turning point in U.S. history, which goes back to the emergence of the new politics on November 7th, with the Democratic landslide in the House and victory in the Senate, largely due to the infusion of young voters in the polls. You can expect more moves from the Congress this week. For example, Representative John Murtha has a bill to stop Bush from sending undertrained and under-equipped troops to a war zone. I'd like to see Republicans try to spin something against that. No, they want to send more undertrained and under-equipped troops. And also you have Senator Biden's announcement that he's moving to repeal the congressional authorization, which is being used by the Bush administration to go to war against Iraq and which is continuing to be used for that purpose. With this kind of reaction, LaRouche said there is a smell of impeachment in the air. Yet, despite these otherwise laudable if overdue moves, there's one crucial area where this Congress is still lagging, and that is on the economy. The financial press is beginning to demonstrate an awareness that the bottom is falling out of the financial system. This week, there were a number of articles from the Financial Times, even in the Wall Street Journal, on how a hard landing from the crash of the real estate bubble, which is underway, is threatening the whole banking system in an order of magnitude bigger blowout than the long-term capital management crash in 1998, which nearly collapsed the global financial system then. However, the Congress has yet to take up this systemic crisis. For example, the disintegration of the auto sector is accelerating exactly as Lyndon LaRouche warned in March 2005 and repeatedly since then. Now you have unregulated hedge funds grabbing up the auto sector, vital U.S. strategic assets in the machine tool sector, either blowing them up or dismantling them and sending them off to other countries, with barely even a whimper of protest. Well, last Tuesday, Lyndon LaRouche spoke in the Italian parliament, and he reinitiated his call for a new Bretton Woods monetary system and the adoption of a 40 to 50-year program of extending massive amounts of credit for constructing a new global infrastructure with an emphasis on new technologies, which would require, in order to be implemented, the advancement of human knowledge through the discovery of new universal physical principles. To accomplish this, you cannot just get pressure on the Congress to adopt new legislation. Instead, it requires the emergence of a new generation of leadership, educated through a process of rediscovering the discoveries of the great minds in history, and then communicating that method of discovery to broader layers of the population. That's what you have to do to create a new renaissance, and that's what we need. Now, becoming this new generation of leadership as a self-conscious process is the task which has been taken up by the LaRouche Youth Movement. For the next hour, we will be joined by several of the LaRouche Youth Movement members who are at the forefront of this project. Our guests will include Chris Landry and Michelle Lerner, who have completed what is called the Kepler 2 project, which we'll be hearing about, and Tarana Dorsey, who is now part of the successor group to Kepler 2. So Chris, Michelle, and Tarana, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Hello, Harley.
Hi. Hello.
Now, I want to begin with a quote from Lyndon LaRouche on this special leadership project and then get your comments on it. This comes from a piece in the January 12th EIR, which has been mass distributed on Capitol Hill and around the country, called What the Congress Needs to Learn, The Lost Art of the Capital Budget. And here's what LaRouche said about this process that I was just describing. He said, quote, "The youth movement which I have fostered has two relatively unique programs of self-development. The first is the development of the notion of the history of science from the standpoint of early classical Greek developments through through such crucial features of modern European development as the work of Kepler, Leibniz, Gauss, and Riemann. The second is the regular activity in developing classical choral work from the standpoint of the Florentine bel canto voice training and the Bach motet. So why don't we start with you, Michelle? What does this statement, this project that's been launched, what does it mean to you? What have you been doing, and how do you understand this work that Lynn has initiated with the LIM?
Okay, well, I would say to begin with, for those who are not so familiar with what we've been doing, Chris, myself, and a couple of others have just been through a process where we spent the past 4.5 to 5 months working through the Harmony of the World, which is a book written by Johannes Kepler closer to the end of his life, not quite at the end of his life, but after years of work on astrophysics. And this work in particular unifies, really makes these two particular aspects of the self-development of the youth movement one idea. And there's certainly a lot that can be said about that, but I would take it from the standpoint of how we've been using this work that we just completed and the website that we've made as a consequence of this work in the organizing process. Over this past week, we in Washington, D.C., have been going into the Congress, also onto campuses, but I think the very more ironic, I guess you could say, aspect of this is going into the Congress and demanding that they learn, they go through the website, get right onto the website.
Go ahead. Michelle? Okay, looks like the conference line is giving us some problems. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
And Tarana?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Chris, we'll get, hopefully Michelle will call back and we'll get a report on the Congress. But you've been taking this work back with you now that you're back in Houston. Why don't you give us your thoughts on this project?
Well, an interesting thing to think about is when Lyndon LaRouche mentions this idea of the history of science and giving people a real sense of what that actually means. The first thing you want to think about is what is uniquely different about human beings from the beasts. Because it's funny to think about that no other species has a history. I mean, the species, other species can have histories in terms of what we've recorded and documented as their history, but it's not history in the truest sense. And what makes mankind unique in order for us to have history? It's fun to think about.
Hold on one second, Chris. Is that Michelle?
Yes.
Okay, you got back on. You got cut off just as you were describing the irony about the work in Congress. And then Chris was filling us in on the difference between man and animals, which I think may be relevant for what you were saying. So let's go back to you on the question of the work in Congress, Michelle.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, that we've been going into the Congress. In certain cases, we've been just working through the website and starting discussions in the cafeterias in the Congress and just pulling people right into this, basically creating a buzz around what we've produced. But also in the offices themselves, I'd have to say over the course of the past several years doing this work in Congress, asking them to pass specific legislation, I found myself in a situation where I had one aide in particular ask, after describing to them what we've been doing, I had one aide in particular ask, well, what type of legislation do you want us to pass? Or would you like us to take up? And I found myself in a situation where I had to explain to them that, well, we've already put that out. We've circulated that on the Hill. The problem is that until you understand what it is that is revolutionary about the mind of Kepler, you're not going to be able to pass this legislation. So it was kind of an interesting irony to be faced with. But that's kind of the revolutionary nature of the work that we're doing. I'm sure Chris had a number of things to say that can get into why that is the case.
Well, let's take up for Chris now, and then Michelle, I do want to come back to see whether you've made some progress in getting some of these congressional aides and staffers to think through this, the fight on a higher level. So, Chris, you were talking about this question of the history of science and what you learned in working on this. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's totally relevant to what Michelle is saying, because if you're looking back at history and you're looking at what uniquely defines the human race as a species, and you see that the human race has progressed over centuries and centuries, even though there's been massive setbacks, what you begin to figure out is that, well, what really defines history is the discovery of universal physical principles by specific historical individuals, which actually moves the species as a whole forwards and gives mankind more power over nature through the, you know, the discoveries of the Egyptians, the ancient Greeks, going through Kuza to Kepler, Leibniz and Gauss, and so on, right? So you see that this issue of progress is necessary for the human species. And you look at someone like Kepler, for instance, and he's, you know, here's Kepler, who's writing in a time period where, you know, you have the 30 Years' War going on, you have Protestants and Catholics and Calvinists and Lutherans and all these different Christian sects killing each other off over the stupidest things. And here's Kepler stuck in the middle of it, who is actually himself a religious person, but doesn't classify himself as any particular religion, because he has issues with both sides, saying, well, how can each one of these sides say they're right and they're wrong when they all believe in the same God and the same Savior? So here he is, writing in the middle of one of the worst time periods of Europe, and, you know, he has his children are dying, he has all these kids that are dying, he has all these hardships, and yet he produces these three great works, his Mysterium Cosmographicum, the New Astronomy, and what we've recently worked through as the Harmony of the World. Now, you think about that time period that Kepler was in, he makes it very clear that his teachers were not of the modern era, but actually came from ancient Greece and Egypt, in particular the Pythagoreans and Plato. So his teachers were thousands of years before him. And he actually makes even clear also that his audience is thousands of years into the future, meaning that he's not thinking about just his moment in his individual moment in history, but he's thinking about his relationship to eternity. And in situating himself in that way, he made this tremendous contribution to the future. Now, he makes this clear, like you can go to the website and see there's this famous quote in the opening page where he talks about how he's stealing the vassals of the ancient Egyptians, right? And he's saying if God had to wait, you know, 6,000 years, then the reader of this book can wait hundreds of more years, So he makes it very clear. Now, the Congress has to get that sort of sense that they're not existing in their moment and they're not, you know, a product of their day-to-day existence, but they have a relationship to eternity in which they have to act upon. And
okay.
It's that sense that we give the Congress.
All right, so you're listening to Chris Landry, Michelle Lerner, and Tarana Dorsey on The LaRouche Show. Let me give the email address if people want to send in questions for them. And if we can't get to your questions on the show, I will make sure the questions are forwarded to them so you can have a communication with them. So it's radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And send your questions in for our panel today. Now, Michelle, let me come back to you then from what you just heard from Chris. What happens when you first present something like this to a congressional aide? Do you get this sense that they're thinking, well, what does this have to do with capital gains tax, or what does this have to do with infrastructure? I can't get the connection.
Well, there's definitely a shock that occurs. I don't think they know quite how to respond at all. There's a certain... there's a certain relationship that seems to have been established between the youth movement and the Congress. They're expecting a certain type of discussion, and they're prepared for that. They, in the past, they have been preparing for a certain type of discussion, whether they just want to say the right things and not really think about it, or even if they have been thinking about it, they're expecting something from you when you go in there. But in this case, what I found over this past week is that there was no prepared response. So it's still a very new and experimental phase in terms of integrating the work that we've done with the Harmony of the World and other of Kepler's writings into the congressional organizing. But as for now, what we're looking to do is create the environment where they can get on the website, look around, and play with it as if it were a toy. So they got to do a little bit more work on their own, but there's certainly an idea to follow up on this and take it to the next level. One of the things that we were also looking at doing is directly contacting members on the Committee on Science and basically stating that we just need a total revolution in scientific thinking if we're going to make any progress. So it's still in the beginning phase, I would say.
We have a relevant question from someone on the email from a Robert Hill in Grover Beach, California, who asks, do you invite the congressional staff to Kepler and Bach experimental sessions?
Yeah, we do. They're timid. They're timid. We've had members. Or not members, but we've had staff come into various meetings in the past. As I said, this is still a newer. We've only been playing with this for about a week now. Next week and last week was somewhat chaotic. They had a lot of things going on. Next week is going to be a little bit more relaxed, depending on whether the session extends with what the Senate does. I'm not sure. I heard they're supposed to be voting today, and there might be, they might actually end up staying next week. But otherwise, there is a plan to have a recess, which gives us a little bit more flexibility to have more time to work through these ideas with them.
Well, the congressional recess also means that people who are listening from around the country, check out whether your congressman is coming back home. Because here's an opportunity to let them know what you think on the Cheney-Bush-Blair war plan for Iran, and then at the same time challenge them to take up this question of the harmonic ordering process of the universe. Before I bring on Tarana, I want to throw out both to the two of you, because I know this was central to the work, this question of the relationship that you discovered between science and music, that it's not just some quirk in Lyndon LaRouche's mind. I hope we didn't lose Michelle again.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're still there?
Okay.
I'm still here, too.
All right. So the idea of a unity of science and music from a Keplerian standpoint is not just some conceit of LaRouche's, but actually you discovered it in a way that may have been almost shocking to you. Can the two of you take that question up?
Mm. Well, I would say that what the implications of this really is, and how you view yourself, your role as human within the universe. LaRouche has been saying for an incredibly long time it's in his economics textbooks. It's been in almost every writing that I've ever seen. If not explicitly, implicitly, that we're living in a universe that is anti-entropic, or I think a better way to put it, a universe that is creative. And it really poses this question of what creativity is. You see this particularly, I think it's more provocative with the case of the way that Kepler uses the idea of a Pythagorean comma in tuning the solar system. it definitely throws a huge paradox out there, because at first you're looking at numbers and the numbers don't seem to really make any sense. But once you start thinking about it from the standpoint that the universe has a composer, well, now you've entered a totally new domain. And the idea of what it means to be creative in a created universe takes on a whole new life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say.
Well, also to add to that, though, is that that's what is implied in the discoveries of Kepler, that you have a universe which is constantly growing and that is creative. For instance, the work on the harmonics, and what you're actually doing is you're getting at the underlying fabric of the universe, the underlying causes of things. And the harmonics is not expressed in a single subject, so to speak. It's not just expressed in, you know, as you learn the college campus today, where you have this plurality of subjects, and they're all different, and they have no relationship to each other. And this being the extreme is the music and the science. You know, you have the guys in the music department who are in war with the guys in the math department, and they don't get along, and there's this big division. You have the left brain, right brain nonsense that you get today, right? But what you're doing with the harmonics is you're getting at the underlying structure, the underlying what's behind what you see and what's behind your senses. And in all the different subjects, they have these ironies, these paradoxes that come up, and there's these similar relationships in all the subjects which imply that there are harmonics. And Kepler goes through this very nicely with the music in Book 3, which is actually where he began the book, and then he figured he had to go back and write these first two books on the planar geometry and the spherical geometry with the Archimedean solids and the Platonic solids and whatnot. But what's interesting with the musical harmonies, just to give an example of a particular case, if you take a string, a cello string or any string, right, and you can divide that string in as many ways as you can. You can infinitely divide that string. You can just slide up it, you know, what they call a glissando, I guess you could say, right, where you just slide up the string. But what you notice is, in working through the harmonics, the world harmony, is that there are very specific locations where harmonic constant intervals occur. And there's only 7 places where that occurs, and you have... From your open string, you take the proportions of the open string and you create the intervals of the minor third, the major third, the diatessaron, the diapent, the minor sixth, the major sixth, and then the octave. And you have those intervals. So what's interesting to think about is that you have this infinite division of space, of string, and there's only these specific intervals where these harmonics occur. Now, Kepler demonstrates that in the motions of the planets, and I'll leave this open for people to discover, because you're going to have to read the book, that those, very important.
And go on the website.
Yes, right. That's why the website's there, right. But they're very, the planets take up those harmonic intervals. And not just only the harmonic intervals, but the interval of intervals, which is where Kepler says the tones are born out of, right? Like, the idea that you have a whole step and a half step is not something self-evident on a piano. And that can actually be very dangerous to think of it that way. And rather, think about it as a relationship of your harmonic intervals that produce the tones. And the solar system expresses this as well. So here you have music, you have it in the geometry, you have it in the solar, the astrophysics, and you have it in even in the further discussions of Kepler, into the snowflake, into the infinitesimally small, which that's what gets taken up later on, I think, after Kepler passes on.
So you're saying that you actually worked through this and discovered that the solar system is tuned.
Sure. And there's even a discrepancy between the motions of Jupiter and Mars, which I think that's what Tarana and her crew are feverishly translating all these works in, around Gauss, to actually get at that question. What is this about? What did Kepler do with his harmonics that leaves this question open?
Well, before we bring on Tarana, let me ask one more question for Michelle, which is that as you then look at this question of harmonics, does this give you more insight into this question of polyphonic singing, as, for example, with the Bach Jesu meine Freude?
Well, that's a bit of a funny question. I guess I can answer it in a sense anecdotally, that as we were on our exit out of the basement, as you can say, we were working through this particular work with the new group that's there now working on the follow-up project. We're working through book three, which is where Kepler discusses where the major and minor modes, how they occur naturally, I guess you could say, where they are derived from. And in a context of that, he has this whole discussion of modes towards the end. Now, this is coming from a time period before Bach, which is a specific type of revolution that occurred in classical composition. And a bit of a discussion came up over the concern as to whether Kepler's approach is how lawful. It's lawful, but it seems like there may have been something missing that Bach picked up on later. And this was a discussion that was occurring as we were working through the third book, where he goes through the specifics of the musical system. But what the thing that I find interesting is that when you look at it from the standpoint of the whole composition, the fifth book, you find that the same type of thinking had to occur in Kepler's mind that Bach was then able to actualize within the musical system and further develop what had come prior, that the same thinking was already there. In that sense, I would say that both lead to insight. That is, Bach gives you insight into the way Kepler was thinking, although Kepler doesn't quite say it explicitly when he's discussing the musical system in Book 3, but if you were able to understand what Kepler is doing with Book 5, then that'll give you further insight into what Bach is doing later on. So it works in a reciprocal way.
So this process that the two of you were involved in was literally a 4 to 5 month process of intense concentrated work.
Yes.
And now you're bringing that back out to you've come out of the basement, you've emerged into the light, and you're teaching your fellow LIM members and congressional aides and university students. How's that going so far?
Well, it's actually going pretty well. But there was recently a presentation I was involved in at the University of Houston here in Houston, Texas. And you had six new people who came in, and you were there, Harley. You saw there's these new faces that were there, and they got a sense of working through something very simple of Kepler, cuz you got to take these things, you got to situate the whole thing, and then you got to be able to give somebody something they can chew on, and like what LaRue says with a new mind, you want to torture them with a paradox, not in Cheney's waterboarding sense, but in the sense that actually helps develop the mind by, instead of giving the answers, you want to be able to have people ask the questions and actually ask the right questions.
Well, we'll take that up when we come back from the break, and we'll also bring in Tarana. You're listening to the LaRue Show. The LaRue Show is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you're listening to it and you're thinking, oh my gosh, my friends are missing this, they should be hearing this, it's archived and it appears on the LaRouchePub.com website. So you can go to LaRouchePub, that's LaRouchePub.com, and you'll see on the left-hand side a thing that says The LaRue Show. And we have archives of back shows going back from the beginning of the LaRue Show. But this one will be the one from February 17th, 2007. Now, if you want some of the literature that we have been talking about, including LaRouche's breakthrough article on the lost art of capital budgeting, which is ultimately going to determine whether this Congress is going to do anything or not, whether they master these ideas, you can get a copy by calling us at 800-929-7566. That's 800-929-7566. It's a free call for you. You can tell them you heard about this on the LaRouche Show. You want a copy of the Executive Intelligence Review. You can specify an issue or just ask in general, and we'll be happy to send it out to you. So it's 800-929-7566. You can also call in contributions to that number. So we're back, and again, Tarana, I'll get to you in just a second, but something that both Chris and Michelle said intrigued me on this idea of how you communicate these matters. And I want to go back to something Lyndon LaRouche said in this Capital Budget article, where he said that the reason you have to work on the science and the music together, besides the fact that that's the way the universe is organized and that's the way the mind functions, is that it's the way you bring passion to science and rigorous precision to art. And he made the following statement. He said, classical irony is an expression of human creativity as a distancing of the individual intellect from boredom, meanness, and a resulting tendency of these towards stupidity. All great art and science are based on an insurgent spirit of creative merriment, a state of happiness in a useful problem-solving mission, a perception that a folly is inherently ridiculous, and that pompous creatures tend to behave like that of which honest donkeys would be sadly ashamed to see in a human being. Irony is incipient laughter, an expression of creative joy in being part of mankind. End of quote from Lyndon LaRouche. With all the hard work you did, I assume that underneath it all was that joy of discovery, and as you see these ironies unfold, and Kepler's very explicit in showing you where he's discovered a folly in his own thinking, I'm presuming that this was very much a part of the work. Michelle or Chris?
Well, it has to be.
Yeah.
The reason I say that is because unless you start with the conception that the universe is created around or generated from a beautiful principle, you'll never really be able to find that which is beautiful in it. You almost have to start with that idea, but it's not self-evident where this beauty occurs. For instance, in the case of the planets, you don't hear these musical harmonies. The musical harmonies are something that it would seem as though you can only hear them, but you don't hear it with the solar system. You have to look for it in another way. But unless you have the intention to stick with that search and have the passion to kind of drive you to continue with it, you won't be able to find it. So you really have to start with the expectation that kind of a process is going to be an incredibly joyful one.
Yeah, I think also the issue of passion that LaRouche is emphasizing, it's, in a sense, to me, it seems like an intersection of many different factors. For one, being able to communicate these ideas to your fellow human beings, right? And recognizing that, you know, through all the problems that people have, because as human beings, you know, especially in this culture, you're dealing with all kinds of problems, and making a beautiful discovery in that process, it can be difficult, especially if you don't have a concentration span, you know, because seeing as in our culture, that seems to be just destroyed by, you know, everywhere you go, the music you hear and everything, right, the traffic and whatnot, you just get these problems, right? But to really develop that, and to look at your human beings, not your fellow human beings, not as a sum of all these problems that they have, but that there is good within every human being, and to actually go with that and understand that you're always working with the best of every person. You can't, you know, this the pessimism and all these things, you have to think through it and actually think, well, what is good in this individual, as opposed to, well, this is a problem, therefore I'm not going to do this. So you have to really think in those terms, in terms of making a scientific discovery or a discovery in music. And I think that really gets at the epistemology, too, of how a human being approaches society or the world around them or thinks of their own mind in terms of, like, actually changing the way they think. Because it's difficult when you grow up thinking one way and you're not exposed to classical art or classical irony or you haven't really developed a classical sense of yourself, then all of a sudden to change the way that you were raised to think, becoming self-conscious of that, that produces a lot of I guess you could say momentum to move yourself to do more. So I
assume, Chris, it also produces a lot of tension.
Right. It's absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Well, Tarana, I understand you've been experiencing some creative tension. Why don't you tell us what your group, which just came in recently, I know you initially did some work with the Kepler 2. Why don't you catch us up to date on what you guys are working on?
Sure. Well, I think I'll start by commenting that what we're really doing, not we as in my group, but this entire youth movement, as you brought up in the quote from Lynn's capital budget paper about the youth curriculum, is because of the time period we find ourselves in, we are taking all of the past most crucial developments that humanity has made thus far and tracing that thread of development that has spanned, you know, several thousands of years, and in the span of, you know, a few months or maybe a bit longer, we in this youth movement are not only recreating, reliving those discoveries, but then disseminating that concept of man and the universe and that relationship into the population as a way that we're going to create a renaissance in our time period, which is really, really exciting. And that really became clear to me when my group was working through the harmonies of the world with the group that Michelle and Chris are a part of. And a lot of the work that they had, you know, really, in a sense, slogged through the mud to figure out, and as, you know, as you're bringing up with Chris, gone through some tense, frustrating moments to figure a lot of this stuff out. Now we are capitalizing off of the work that they've done to go further, the next step, which is, just to give a brief summary, we're going to be delving into the discovery or the application of Kepler's discovery too much later by a mathematician, Carl Friedrich Gauss, in really, beginning in the year 1801, where there was a sighting of an asteroid named Ceres, which was observed by an Italian astronomer named Piazzi. And then a year later, Gauss's method of figuring out the relationship of this orbit to the rest of the solar system was validated and applied, and was in the footsteps or a real application of that, of Kepler's idea of a fabric of harmony underlying the solar system.
And what have you discovered of the connection between Gauss and Kepler? Because you're talking now about a couple hundred years.
Yeah, well, that's the first thing we really ran into when we found ourselves in the basement discussing how we're going to approach this mission that LaRouche has laid out for us. And the first thing you really run into, if you put yourself in the shoes of thinking about how you would approach this problem, what you first find is that, contrary to Kepler, who's very jovial and transparent about his approach and his entire method and every stumbling block that he came upon and how he overcame it, you know, for the most part, Gauss is, because of the historical circumstances that he's living in, explicit about not being explicit about his method. In fact, in the official publication of his investigation of the planetary orbits in 1809, called the Theoria Motus, he says in the preface that the method he actually lays out in this work is not the one that he actually used in 1801, 1802 to investigate the orbit of asteroid Ceres. So thus, what that leaves us to do is to figure out, to trace the arc of thought and development from Kepler's investigation and what he left through Leibniz to Gauss and some crucial figures along the way there, for instance, Kessner, who was Gauss's teacher, and to begin to investigate what Gauss's method actually was, which means that we can't fudge it. We have to actually redevelop and recreate, relive and recreate that discovery that Gauss made. And a lot of these, a lot of the writings and correspondences, you know, we're going to glean a certain amount of an idea from that. But a lot of these are in German, so I could tell you some about some of the historical digging that we've been doing at the Library of Congress if you want to know about that.
Well, it's actually interesting because Chris was talking earlier about Kepler living during the 30 Years' War, and in a certain sense you could hear from his discussion that it was Chris is now very familiar with the 30 Years' War, almost as though he lived through it. And Tarana, your group is going to be steeped in the whole question of the battle in the 18th century to defend Leibniz from those forces around, in particular Voltaire and Maupertuis, but the Anglo-Dutch establishment's efforts to destroy the legacy of Leibniz. So do you find that you actually are almost, you are living through these periods, through the battles that were going on in these great figures?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One example of this in our investigation, because what we have done is looked through some of Gauss's correspondences, the letters that he was writing with other astronomers of the time, and also a close friend of his from Göttingen University, where all of the people he was associating with at Göttingen were part of this network that you're describing, which was the key network defending the scientific method and view of the universe of Leibniz, his philosophical view. In fact, that was, you know, one of the key figures at that time. I already mentioned Kessner, who was a teacher of Gauss, was the key figure in Germany at this time defending this method. And he wrote just a huge portion of works that have not been translated into English to this time. So what we did when we went to the Library of Congress was to look at a lot of these works that Kessner is putting out on astronomy, geometry, trigonometry, a lot of this stuff that, you know, Gauss was directly exposed to, where and Kessner talks about Kepler all the time, and then also looking at the actual published correspondence called Sachs Monatliche Correspondence, which was where all of the writings by Gauss and other astronomers were being published during this whole excitement around the discovery of the orbit of Ceres. And one thing that we found while we were at the Library of Congress is a lot of these works, these books that we checked out or were looking through, have never been opened, never looked at, because we actually had to cut the pages to be able to look through some of the German correspondences and letters. And other books that we were looking at had not been checked out since 1903.
Wow.
So what that illustrates to us is that this period of history has not ever before in our nation been brought out, fleshed out for people to have a sense of the breakthroughs and the historical fight that took place in the background of this discovery of Gauss. And so part of our mission really is going to be not just to recreate and relive that discovery of Gauss, but to bring into color a whole historical fight that was taking place in that 18th century.
And this is how academic hoaxers get away with saying that it was Locke who was responsible for the U.S. Constitution,
yes,
and destroy this idea that there was a living continuity from Leibniz directly to the Founding Fathers. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We are discussing the Kepler 2 project. Tarana, what you were just talking about reminded me of a report I think we had in from, maybe it was from Oakland or Seattle, where we went to an astronomy department of a major university and found that virtually no one had read Kepler, that in fact they had comments on Kepler about how he was arcane and mystical, but had not worked through that. Now, Michelle, have you You mentioned that you've done some work on the campuses. I assume that's a pretty universal experience, that there aren't very many people who have done the kind of work that you guys just did.
Well, most people think that Isaac Newton had an apple fall on his head, and that's how gravity was discovered. And when you ask people if they know who discovered gravity, I think they're kind of shocked to find out that it wasn't Newton. I think that's telling.
Mm-hmm.
I think that shows just how steeped people are in what the textbooks say, as opposed to real history, especially considering that the new astronomy was written way before Newton was even born.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, I think Kepler threw that apple at Newton's head.
Well, one wonders what Newton was doing under an apple tree in any case, knowing his proclivities, but
yes,
that's another question. But you see, this brings up the deeper question that I opened the program with today, which is that the only way to get a shift in policy making that will get us out of this crisis that's pushing us into a dark age is going to be this kind of investigation, this kind of work. And we live in a culture where this is virtually written off. So as you know, in Italy, one of the points Lyndon LaRouche made was that you have to have a new leadership which is optimistic. So how do you see things coming together with the continuing work you're going to be doing with Kepler and the music and the organizing process? Let's just start with Michelle. Do you have some thoughts about how this can be a transformational moment for the country?
Well, yeah, we are the leadership. I mean, that's really what I would say. We are the leadership. Anything that comes out of the Congress is ultimately going to be determined by what we do. Any major shifts that occur in the population is being driven by the work that we're doing. And the only real way of having a sense of optimism is if you're always looking at developing the future, you always have to have an image of what you want the future to be in your mind. That's the true source of optimism. And given that we've just unleashed the beginnings of a revolution which now which has occurred in a concentrated way with a number of people that have been doing the leading work on this issue of Kepler's discoveries, that is now, we're beginning to have a process where that is now being transmitted to the rest of the youth movement, and also beyond that into the young people that we're reaching out to bring into the youth movement to continue to participate in that. So looking at that, you have the basis for a very rich idea of the future. Now, looking at that from the standpoint of how this past election, the November election, functioned, that it was precisely this age group, the 18 to 35 age group, which made the decisive, cast the decisive votes, I think we have a real basis for some real progress in the United States, but in the world as a whole.
So a lot of this is what LaRouche refers to as the new politics. But Chris, let me ask you, Lynn has also said the old economics is dead. Now we need the new economics. How do you see the work we're doing with Kepler feeding into the end of monetarism, the end of globalization, and the launching of a new isotope economy?
Well, that's a nice task. I mean, just to think about the harmonics, the work on the harmonics is almost, besides figures like Gauss and Leibniz and very few others. There really has been no work on harmonics since Kepler. And in fact, it was ridiculed, I think, by Spinoza as, you know, the insane man's science. But to actually investigate these things and see how that the universe is harmonic raises some interesting questions that have yet to be investigated in science today. In terms of, for instance, the work that Dr. Robert Moon did with his Moon model, and looking at the composition of the atomic nucleus, not in terms of what you would call the magic numbers and looking at purely numbers for the organization of elements and isotopes, but actually looking at the physical harmonic characteristics, say, for instance, what you would find between the platonic solids and their relationships, or the Archimedean solids even in their relationships. And that opens up a whole new approach to subatomic physics and whatnot, right? Which could advance that opens the door potentially for new sources of energy into fission, fusion, and new sources of power to move away from what we're doing now from the oil and coal-based economy, moving into this, you know, cornaholic economy where they're burning corn, you know, and putting the farmers out, you know, and bankrupting the economy.
You know what I say on that, Chris?
What's
that? If you
want
to burn corn, make some popcorn. Leave it in the microwave too long. Go ahead.
Sure. No, I mean, sure. Like, why? That's it's a regression, you know. So in terms of the globalization and all these things, it brings everything down to the least common denominator instead of the greatest factor, right? The greatest common factor. So you want to bring everything up and progress science by looking into these things, right, where you have all these paradoxes that come up in science today, and by looking at the fundamental thread of science, where modern science was actually developed in terms of like what Plato outlines in the Timaeus and through Kepler, you're actually getting an idea of how to investigate the universe you exist in, as opposed to just having the facts and saying, well, I got fact A and fact B and fact C. Well, the question is, well, what universe do you exist in where all these facts happen? Are those even true? And that would actually open up a method by which, take for instance, you have all these scientists out there, right, who have a lot of, some of them are good people, they have a lot of knowledge in their head about these scientific facts, about the periodic tables and et cetera and so on and so forth, right? But they have no way to really organize this quote-unquote statistical data in order for them to make a hypothesis that would further science. And a lot of them probably really want to, but they're just not given that opportunity, especially today. So with the work we've done on Kepler, hopefully that opens up the door to free a lot of these thinkers out there, whether they're in our movement or not in our movement, and, you know, in the international community, wherever they are, to actually take up this challenge and then begin the investigations in the necessary fields of science to progress humanity into the future.
And that can take us beyond the statistical, mechanical approach to economics, which is leading us to a complete global meltdown of every major financial institution in the world and replace it with a new set of principles for economics based on dynamics. Now, Tirana, you've just gotten your feet wet so far. I will tell you there is an email from someone who is obviously quite intrigued by what you said that you found in the Library of Progress, Library of Congress, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it should be a Library of Progress. But anyway, I think they have an image of you guys going into a crypt. But you are working through then a whole range of material building up to the Orbit of Ceres project, is that right?
Yeah, what we're doing right now is reworking through the harmonies to get a very firm foundation in the method of Kepler and his approach to harmonics so that when we start to tackle the Gauss, we'll be able to draw out this continuity and arc of development and sort of illustrate that.
We have about 5 minutes left, 6 minutes left. Any of you have a question for each other, or Michelle, I'd actually like to know, I understand you were in a choral rehearsal this morning. How does the choral work benefit from knowing that the universe is polyphonic?
Well, the
From what I've been able to, one of the things that I got out of the harmony of the world is that the organization of the solar system, as Kepler investigates it, he first starts from the standpoint that since both the major and minor modes were the natural modes that he found in Book 3 based upon the harmonic divisions of the string, that those two modes had to exist simultaneously in the solar system. So he started with an idea of the whole, and this comes up in the choral work, not because you're not looking at a solar system in the sense we think of a solar system, but in a certain sense you are. You're looking at several voices, each traveling their own pathway, but they're all interacting. But the way that the whole piece was composed was from the standpoint of the whole in the mind of the composer. So one of the things that I've been actually thinking about is the importance of rehearsals, because ultimately what we want to do is be able to competently perform this, especially in the streets as we're organizing the population. But from the standpoint of thinking about developing an ability of competent performance, that you have to start from the standpoint of the whole. And we actually had a discussion with a number of people this morning about orienting the rehearsals from the standpoint of doing as much, rather than individual sectional work, which is what we had been doing, of tuning each of the pathways, I guess you could say, each of the voices to themselves, and then using that to bring it together, try to do much more of the fully integrated choral work to really get a thought of where each of these voices sits in relationship to the rest of the voices.
Because the change that you experience in the comma is not in an individual voice, but between the voices.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I want the listeners to know where they can go to find the website where the summary presentation that your group gave, where it is. It was a four-hour presentation, spectacular discussion that was pulled together around this. In a sense, you have a coda at the end on the music, which pulls everything together from Megan Beats. So, Chris, where can listeners find this presentation?
Well, if you go to the website, the direct path to get there.
Which website?
Our website, the Kepler 2 Project website on the harmonies.
Okay.
So that would be www.wlym.com/Kepler. That will take you straight to the home page, and there will be an introduction section, which will have three parts. It'll have a technical advice page on how to actually navigate the website. The second page will be the thank yous and for the many people who actually helped pull this together. And the third would actually be an archive of the classes that we gave. And there you can find it. It's the third class on the page. There's three classes, and they were given in different time periods. It actually is interesting to listen to all three because you see the development mm-hmm. in our own minds of how this actually came about.
All right, so say that again. Give the website and the location.
www.wlym.com/Kepler. That's K-E-P-L-E-R. And you'll find it right there.
Okay, so I think there are a lot of people who have been listening to this who are quite intrigued now and should take the time to look at this. Is there something that's going to come out in writing in the EIR at some point?
We're going to be putting together an interactive DVD with the class on it. I don't know if there's plans yet for an article in the EIR. This past EIR had a press release that Chris wrote announcing the website. So we're definitely working on a DVD.
Okay. Well, people who want to get a copy of this, you can call us. The number again is 800 929-7566. The website is www.wlym.com/Kepler. And I'd like to thank the three of you both for being on today, but also for the work you're doing with the LaRouche Youth Movement.
Thank you, Harley.
Thanks, Harley.
Yeah, so thank you very much. And for our listeners, I hope you're intrigued, maybe a little puzzled. It's time to do some work. Roll up your sleeves and get on it. This has been the LaRouche Show. Tune in again next week.